Let us come together now in worship. Let us open our minds to the challenge of reason, our hearts to the healing of love. Open our lives to the calling of conscience and open our souls to the comfort of joy. Astonished by this miracle of life and grateful for this gift of fellowship, confident in the power of a living faith, we are here gathered. Come, let us worship together. As the Labritalic family come forward to light our chalice, I invite you all to turn to the unison words of chalice lighting in your order of service. May this light kindle within us the warmth of compassion, the glow of love, the fire of commitment, and the light of truth.
Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
I have a story for you. This is a story that starts like all good stories. How would it start? There was a girl named Mariah who was full of questions. When she asked, "What's that? And what's this? And what are those? And what are these?" And her parents answered as best they could. "That's a dog, and this is a cat, and those are dog whiskers, and these are cat's feet." Her parents gave her lots of answers, but she always had more questions. When Mariah was, she started to ask, "How? How does that work? How does that happen? How do we know how it goes?" Her parents tried to answer as best as they could. "Boiling water makes steam, and steam pushes the lid of the kettle, and we know because, well, because we do." "But how?" Mariah wanted to know. "How do you know?" "Well, because we look at it, and we wonder, and we do experiments to find out answers." "You can do experiments, too." When Mariah was, she started to ask, "Why? Why do boats float? Why does it get dark at night? Why do cats have fur, and why do people wear clothes?" Her parents tried to answer as best as they could. But no matter how many answers they had, Mariah always had more questions. She asked questions at home. She asked questions at school. She asked questions at the Quaker church where her family belonged. She asked questions of everyone she met, hundreds of questions, thousands of questions, millions of questions, an infinity of questions from one little girl. Mariah had an infinity of questions, and she loved the infinity of the stars. In the evenings, she and her father would climb the stairs to the top floor of their house in Nantucket, Massachusetts, by the sea. Then they would climb up on a ladder and go onto the roof, and on the roof was a small platform. It was called a widow's walk, and from the top of the house, Mariah could see far out to sea. She could see far above her to the stars, hundreds of stars, thousands of stars, millions of stars, an infinity of stars, and one little girl. "I love the stars," she told her father. And they would look through a telescope and see further into the sky. Then Mariah started to ask questions. Where do the stars come from? How old are they? Why do they shine? How many are there? How far away are they? Some questions her father could answer, some he could not. So Mariah set out to find the answers herself. She studied hard, read books, and did experiments, and she became an astronomer. That's a person who studies the stars. And when she was 29, she discovered a comet. It was named the Mitchell Comet after her, and the King of Denmark gave her a medal for discovering the comet. In 1848, the very same year this building was built, she was named a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which never had had a woman member before. But Mariah was still full of questions. How do we know God exists? Is the Bible true? Why are we here? Some people gave her answers, but when Mariah asked, "How do you know?" they answered, "Because we do. Because we read it in a book. And so that's the way it is, and you shouldn't ask anymore." Mariah didn't think that was a very good answer at all. But the answers to her questions weren't to be found in books or by doing experiments. So Moriah kept asking. One day, she heard a talk by a Unitarian minister named William Ellery Channing. He didn't have the answers, but he said that there was room for an infinity of answers to the infinity of questions. And the important thing was to wonder, not to know. Moriah decided to join the Unitarian Church because those words woke up her mind. All through her life, Moriah Mitchell asked what and how and why. She became a teacher so she could help others people answer their questions. And in 1865, she became a professor of astronomy at Vassar College, and she taught other people about the stars. Sometimes they found the answer to the questions, and sometimes they didn't. But Moriah Mitchell was happy either way, because the most important thing was to wonder, and not to always know. There are times when the issues upon which we are asked to vote in elections need to be addressed from the pulpits of churches because they present important moral, theological, and ethical questions. Often these questions are questions to which there are no clear right or wrong answers. In this religious tradition, although we do take positions on moral issues of the day, this church does not tell you what you should believe or how you should vote. The wisdom of your individual conscience is as good as mine and should be your guide as to how you apply the theological concepts and ethical principles of your faith. But what this tradition does insist upon is that we engage in a rigorous, disciplined, and honest search for truth and meaning, and that we do so with love, compassion, and justice in our hearts. Instead of doctrine or dogma, instead of a church hierarchy telling us how we should vote, we uphold the right of the individual conscience. In this upcoming election, we'll be asked to vote for or against physician-assisted suicide. This is a difficult issue for most of us. I see the merits, and I see the weaknesses and fears on both sides of the debate. I see people advocating from a place of love and compassion on both sides. Question 2 on the ballot does not propose a general legalization of physician-assisted suicide. The proposed law at least attempts to limit availability to those suffering from a terminal illness within 6 months or less to live. There are some precautions set out in the law to try and assure that the individual is truly making this request of his or her free will and after real consideration. Whether these medical determinations are really reliable and uninfluenced by factors other than the patient's physical condition, and whether these precautionary steps really result in a determination of the patient's true desire is a matter we'll consider later. But first, I want to put this issue in a broader context. We all know that there'll be a time for each of us to die. As Scripture reminds us, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under the sun. There is a time to be born and a time to die. When those ancient words from Ecclesiastes were written, life and death were issues that did not require a lot of decision-making. Apart from war or violence, death came about when it did. Yes, there were suicides. I know Socrates drank the hemlock. But what I'm talking about today is different. Today, the progress of medical science has placed upon us the burden and the opportunity to make many ethical and practical decisions that the writers of those words in Ecclesiastes never could have anticipated. Today, with the medical and legal tools available to us, we can have some control over our final days. None of us look forward to death, but I think we all want a good death, one without pain, that preserves as much of our dignity and control as possible. And surely this is the motivating force behind this proposed law. But the question I ponder with you today is whether the passage of this law is the best means to that end, And are there other consequences, not just to the individual who dies from the lethal dose of medication prescribed by his doctor, but to society, if this is made legal? Some of us and some of our friends and family will die without major medical decisions having to be made. But many of us have made, and others will be faced with making heart-wrenching decisions for our parents, our spouses, and our loved ones. Most of us probably hope that we'll just drop one day and not have to make the decision, and we probably hope we won't have to be in the position of deciding to pull the plug on a loved one. Yet in my ministry, I've found that whether the patients are making the decision for themselves or others are having to make the decision for them, there is a sense of peace and even empowerment when the tubes are removed and nature is allowed to take her course. It can be an act of love and compassion to allow a person to die when we know it is truly their choice and their time. To be able to honor someone's wishes when they cannot act may be painful, but it also can be a very positive experience, the final gift you can give to that person. It has been my experience that when we make those decisions with love and courage and honesty, there is a sense of relief. When the extraordinary medical intervention is avoided or terminated, when pain is managed and death comes on its own terms, there is a sense of the truth and comfort in those words of Ecclesiastes. For everything, there is a season, and a time for every matter under the sun, a time to be born, and a time to die. I believe strongly in the right to make choices in determining our own end-of-life care, or that of a parent or spouse or family member. And I encourage everyone to clearly express your wishes to your doctor and to the person who holds your health care proxy, and to other family members as well, for you cannot make your wishes known too many times. One of my colleagues tells a true story of one of his parishioners, an elderly gentleman named Victor, who was in serious physical decline. He was admitted to the hospital, dying of several different diseases and conditions at the same time. He was a very opinionated retired college professor and was very clear on what he wanted and didn't want. He filled out all the proper forms meticulously, making clear that he did not want to be resuscitated. But somehow the message didn't get passed to the hospital night shift. So when Victor's heart stopped, they put those paddles on his chest and shocked his heart back into pumping again. Victor immediately opened his eyes and looked up at the man holding the paddles, and in his most stern voice said, "Don't do that again." The medical people were quite surprised, but this time they honored his wishes and didn't, and just a few minutes later, Victor passed away. We all need to be clear about our wishes for our final days. To me, when death comes about as a result of refraining from extraordinary measures like resuscitating an elderly dying patient or withdrawing life support and only treating pain, even if that treatment hastens death, it feels like death has come on its own terms, at its right time. In these situations, we have not really caused the death, but we have welcomed it. Today, there's a movement to expand our end-of-life decision-making to allow for an ill person to choose when to die. By allowing doctors to prescribe or administer lethal doses of medication. In 1997, now 15 years ago, Oregon became the first state to pass a physician-assisted suicide law, and it's now legal in two other states as well. But in several states, it's been on the ballot and has failed to pass. And as you know, those of us in Massachusetts will be asked to vote on this question in just a few weeks. Switzerland has permitted physician-assisted suicide since 1941. Belgium and the Netherlands permit doctors to euthanize terminally ill patients and others who are in extreme pain who wish to die. Now, even in some European countries, doctors are allowed to euthanize patients who cannot communicate for themselves at the request of family members. This gives me pause. I believe strongly in individual liberty. And to me, that means that every competent person has a right to apply their own religious and philosophical conviction and make their own decisions. This faith tradition stands on that freedom. And I see, in fact, the course of history, especially in this country, as one of increasing individual liberty and greater individual control over how we live our lives and over our bodies. And I see this potential right as another possible step on that path, just like the civil rights, gay rights, or women's rights movements have been. We are a religion that values individual freedom highly. But that's not the only religious basis from which we might argue in favor of this right. Our religions, like most religions, calls us to act with compassion and do what we can to relieve all kinds of suffering. And moreover, we value the dignity of every person. And I know many horrible diseases can rob us of that dignity. I could envision myself wanting to make such a request for suicide help if my suffering of some horrible disease was intense and my end was near. So my intellect tells me that I should reach the conclusion that when a terminally ill patient asks a physician to should be able to prescribe drugs to end that person's life. In 1988, Unitarian Universalist Association passed a resolution supporting this position, known as the Right to Die with Dignity. And that resolution reads in part, "We, the Unitarian Universalist Association General Assembly, resolve that all people have the right of self-determination in dying, with release from civil or criminal penalties of those who, under proper safeguards, act to honor the rights of the terminally ill patient's right to select the time of their own death." But just because a resolution is passed by our General Assembly, we as Unitarian Universalists are not required to accept that point of view, and indeed, many Unitarian Universalists disagree with this position. Personally, I feel pulled to support this legislation, but I'm held back in doing so by my beliefs and my life experience. And although I believe in a person's right to refuse or withdraw from treatment, I struggle greatly with the idea that any form of active euthanasia should be permitted in our society. And there are many reasons I feel this way. The first, on a very practical level, although the precautions written into the law may seem sufficient, the determinations that doctors are asked to make are anything really but easy and clear, and still, I believe, highly likely to be influenced by other first forces. It's no surprise to me that medical doctors overwhelmingly oppose this legislation. Under this legislation, a doctor must determine that a person has less than 6 months to live. Now, they make that kind of determination right now all the time in order to entitle people to hospice care. And I know from personal experience that it's not particularly accurate. And sometimes the doctor will sort of stretch that a bit in order to get the patient's services that they need and can be paid for under Medicaid if they're not otherwise so classified. Take the case of Uncle T, whom you know makes his way into my sermons with some regularity. He had congestive heart failure at the age of 96, no great surprise, and his 6 month period to live was extended 3 times, which allowed the extra nursing and social work visits which he absolutely loved. He lived nearly 2 years after the first determination that he had only 6 months to live. The next issue that concerned me is the determination that medical professionals are asked to make about the person's request for assisted suicide being truly reflective of his or her desire and free from any outside influence. I believe that even with the procedures the law sets out, the decision to terminate life can be heavily influenced by outside sources, some of which are connected in a personal way and some of which I believe are financial interests. I believe that these interests can be so powerful to a vulnerable person that the decision to terminate one's life could be made by many for the wrong reasons. I've seen patients for whom the idea of being a burden to their family weighed incredibly heavily upon them. And I have seen family members grow very impatient with a dying person. You know, they don't have any more time to take off from work to spend with the dying person, so they want to get on with this thing. And I don't trust our for-profit medical system, where more and more every policy and decision is based upon the financial bottom line. You know, when things get too costly, when families get stressed out, when people don't feel wanted, I worry that for some, this right to die would begin to seem almost like a duty to die. You know, it'll often be in a time of crisis that these life and death decisions are made. Often the person is suffering such emotional depression that it overrides their true values and their lifelong enduring beliefs. I've sat with several people who, after their doctor told them that they were not going to be cured from their disease, told me that they just wanted to die now, not wait for the cancer or whatever to play out. They wanted to take some pills and save their family the suffering, save themselves the loss of living their life the way they were used to. But often, when I would go back to visit them weeks or months later, when perhaps they'd had some treatment, medication for depression or anxiety, or perhaps they just had a good family visit, they changed their tune dramatically. I remember a woman who wanted to die so badly after getting bad news from her doctor. And I visited her a couple of weeks later, and she showed me a picture of her holding her new grandchild. And she said, "I'm going to try and make it at least for the first birthday party. Who knows?" I've suggested to you that the limitations are not that clear, and the possibility of extraneous issues entering into this decision are still very present. But you know, even if I'm wrong about all of that, and the law could be perfectly implemented, I have to ask, is this a path we want to travel as a society? You know, if we recognize something as a right, and I know it's my legal side talking a little here, but it seems to me both legally and practically difficult to limit its expansion. For instance, why only allow it 6 months before a person is expected to die? Why not a year? Or why not at the very onset of a terminal disease, so as to avoid any embarrassing decline and go out at the top of your game? Why only pills that you have to swallow on your own? Is that fair to the person who's paralyzed and can't pick up the pills or swallow them? Why not lethal injections given by a doctor? And why do you have to be dying? What about chronic intolerable pain or total paralysis, where someone is a prisoner in an otherwise healthy body? If it's a right, why is your decision to end your life any less valid in all those situations? I don't think we can recognize the right to physician-assisted suicide without starting down this path. We've actually seen it already happen in Europe. What I fear will happen over time is that we as a society will begin to make presumptions about which lives are worth living and which are not, presumptions that should never be ours to make about others. And those presumptions will then become standards, expectations of how others will behave in our society. One reason people want options, the option of physician-assisted suicide, is, of course, the fear of horrible pain in their last days. And it's an understandable fear. But today, with better palliative care techniques, almost all pain is controllable. It's not perfect. But I'm so grateful that there are now doctors who devote their entire practice to just this kind of care, and they are wonderful. And even I'm more grateful for hospice care, which does so many wonderful things to make the final days as pleasant and as pain-free as possible. As I said, it's not perfect. But this kind of care is getting better all the time. And I fear that the incentive for better and better palliative care, especially pain management, may be reduced if this option of physician-assisted suicide becomes the norm. I understand that most of us desire to be in control right to the end. But the truth is, folks, we'll lose some control as we age, and certainly if we're seriously ill. And dying involves a loss of control. When death happens naturally, when there is a release to the will of God or the course of nature, there can be a sense of peace and resignation, even fulfillment. It's been my experience that when dying people let go of control, the final days become sacred time for them and their family. I know control is important, but in the end, I don't think it's the most important thing. I've come to the decision to vote no on question two for ethical, practical, and theological reasons. I've shared with you many of the reasons why I think it would be wrong to legalize physician-assisted suicide. Finally, from a big-picture theological perspective, I'd like to make a couple other overarching observations. I don't believe that we are pawns on this earth controlled by some distant chess-playing God who's offended or not by what we do. I don't believe that suicide is some great sin for which we'll burn in hell. However, I do believe that I am not the measure of all things, including my life, and that there are some things that I must accept rather than control, and that there is purpose and meaning in everything that I experience. I certainly believe we're called to be compassionate, to relieve pain and uphold individual freedom, but also to affirm the fullest possible life for everyone at every stage in life. I know there are many people here who surely feel differently than I do on this issue, and I have to say I'm a bit surprised that I decided to vote against the right to physician a suicide. But perhaps it's good for you to know that I hold at least one more conservative position. But how to vote on question two in the upcoming election is your very personal decision. And in truth, there are religious teachings, moral values, and ethical positions that can be used to support either side. We all have different life experiences and different relationships with those who've been dying, and that colors our views. But whether or not there is a legal option to end a life by taking a doctor-prescribed dose of medicine, my prayer is that our decision in any end-of-life circumstance will always be guided by unselfish love and the highest of moral values. As I said before, what I think we're trying to get at with this ballot initiative is really the question of what makes for a good death. I've given you some of my thoughts, but I think there's one more ingredient. What makes for a good death is not a bottle of pills, but love, compassion, and care from others. How we live the days leading up to our final days, the bonds we build and the lives we share, is probably the greatest medicine to help us cross the bridge from life to death with dignity.